Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Vision, the eyes, and nutrition. We usually take our eyes for granted until something happens to compromise their functioning. We've been learning on the show how much nutrition can make an extraordinary difference in our health and in our developing children. Today we'll be looking closely at our eyes and how to support and improve their function with nutritional support and how to ensure the healthy vision development for our children from the womb throughout their school years. How many children are diagnosed with a learning disorder when they're actually suffering from a vision problem? Today's guest is optometrist Dr. Jeffrey Anschell, author of Smart Medicine for Your Eyes. Join us in the next hour as we discuss the treatment of vision and the eyes with nutrients, herbs, and homeopathy. So we'll be going over some common eye disorders, and we'll also talk about what role nutrition plays in the development and health of the eyes. So let me get my guest on the line and welcome him to the show, Dr. Jeffrey Anschell. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Lena.
Thank you. Jeffrey Anschell received his Bachelor of Science in Visual Science in 1974 and his Doctorate of Optometry in 1975 from the Illinois College of Optometry. A lieutenant in the U.S. Navy from 1975 to 1977, he established the Navy's first vision therapy center located in San Diego, California. In 1978, he went into private practice offering his patients in Solana Beach, California, nutritional counseling, vision therapy, color therapy, acupressure, and other alternative therapies as part of their vision care. Today, in addition to his practice, Dr. Anschell is president of Corporate Vision Consulting, where he gives on-site lectures to help computer users minimize eye and vision problems. So thank you so much for taking the time out from your busy practice to join us.
Yes, you're welcome.
I think the first thing that we might as well get out of the way is just this issue of the difference between different types of eye doctors so people can get a sense of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, that is a very confusing topic. Basically, there's three types of eye care professionals. One is ophthalmologists, who are MDs, and then after their medical school training, they take a three-year internship and specialize in eye diseases and surgery. And then there's optometrists, of which I am one. And optometrists spend a four-year curriculum after college to specialize in eye care, looking at a little bit different aspects of it, more of the functional vision aspects of it, how we use our eyes, vision development, and just how our eyes are being used on a daily basis. And we also are well-versed in detecting eye diseases and problems like that, but we don't do surgery. And then there's opticians who basically fill prescriptions from optometrists and ophthalmologists.
It's clear from your book, once again, that there's a tremendous difference in the health of the eyes and the development of the eyes mm-hmm. in relationship to the nutrient value of a person's diet. And in addition, it seems that you are in favor of supplementation of vitamins.
Yes, I am.
One of the things that I think might be interesting to talk about here is that when you look at the basis for different types of health problems related to the eyes, there is increasing interest these days among complementary doctors, not just in relationship to the eyes, but in relationship to all health problems mm-hmm. in the circulatory system. There's a great deal of emphasis now being put on checking for clotting factors in the blood. That's homocysteine and lipoprotein A and fibrinogen. And it occurred to me reading the initial part of your book where you describe, again, the anatomy of the eye when you're going over it, that how intricate the circulatory system to the eye is.
Oh, yes. It's very intricate. Actually, the interesting part about the eye is that you can actually, in looking into the eye, you can actually see the blood vessels in their normal working state without having to cut into the body. And that's by looking into the pupil, into the back of the eye. There are actual blood vessels lying on top of the retina, and you can actually see them in their normal functioning state, and you can tell a lot of problems just by looking at them and seeing how they're functioning.
So I would think that the things, I mean, in the same way, the two most important things about nutrition, not solely, not to the exclusion of everything else, but one of the two most important things would be maintaining good circulation throughout the entire body, not just the eyes, to protect the eyes. Is it the case that many of the pathologies that we see, the critical pathologies, or the degenerative diseases of the eye are also related to circulation?
Yes, and actually one of the more common ones that's getting a lot of attention these days is called macular degeneration.
Right.
And my way of looking at it is that the macula is the center portion of the retina that it's the portion where we get our 20/20 from. When we look at something, we line it up with the macula part of the retina. And because it requires such accurate vision, accurate seeing, it can't have any direct blood vessels going right to the area. So it does require a very fine network of blood around the area. And so these blood vessels are very tiny, very delicate, and they're kind of at the end point of receiving nutrition. So if there's a difference in the way people are obtaining their nutrition, they're going to that's the area that's going to suffer the most. So
what did you mean by if there's a difference in the way people are obtaining their nutrition?
Well, for example, one of the classics that I like to point to is smoking, because it affects the arteries and veins so significantly that a smoker will have, the arterioles and the capillaries that are in that area will just be starved for blood supply. And I look at that as being part of the way that macular degeneration actually starts, is by a decrease in the amount of blood flowing into that into the area of the macula, and it changes. Now, smokers, again, are primed for that, and there's a number of other factors that that do contribute to macular degeneration, age being obviously the main one, because we see it most with people in their 60s or 70s. But there's diet and nutrition. There's just the macula has fragile cells that are highly susceptible to damage from free radicals.
Okay, so now we're talking about antioxidant vitamins. Exactly. When we talk about free radicals.
Right. So it's a combination of, just how much nutrients are actually getting to that area, because it's difficult to get nutrients to the area because it doesn't have a direct blood supply.
So what types of vitamins, I have something in mind already, but what types of vitamins would increase the effectiveness of nutrients in the body? What would get the circulatory system to push those vitamins into the eye?
Well, a lot of the antioxidants we look at, vitamin A, beta carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, also selenium, and also lutein. And there's a lot of research going on about lutein right now, and its cousin, zeaxanthin. And these are antioxidants that are very prominent in the retina itself. And we find that with macular degeneration, the levels of lutein is depleted.
Lutein is a carotenoid. It's a coloring that appears in, lutein is the green, is it, in spinach and kale and whatnot,
right, exactly.
I believe. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it seems to me that the carotenoids like to be with each other. They like to have other carotenoids around. So the beta carotene is the one in carrots.
Uh-huh.
And then we've got the lycopene, which is... So everyone's so excited about for cancer, which is from tomatoes and the red. And the last one that you mentioned in your book, and I don't know what coloring that is.
Was it the zeaxanthin?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of an offshoot of lutein. It's like I said, it's a cousin of it.
So it's green.
Yeah.
It's a green one again. So
actually,
it's green.
The yellow as well. Lutein.
Oh.
The macula has a yellow. There's yellow pigmentation in the macula.
That's interesting.
So there's yellow in there, too.
So I would think that the other things that are generally good for circulation are going to be terribly important for the eyes. So there are fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin E that
right.
improve circulatory function and prevent clotting, which is any kind of clotting situation or clotting factors are going to really interfere with. This is not just smokers that are going to have problems with this.
Right.
Right? It's going to be anybody whose circulatory system isn't functioning as well as they ought to be. These
right.
are people who maybe are too ill to exercise or have not exercised much in their lives, and
mm-hmm.
People who have family histories of, who have strokes, lots of strokes mm-hmm. in the family, and heart disease and whatnot.
Yeah, any circulatory problems are going to be...
And we're going to see it in families also with, I think, my guess is that there may be some correlation between dementia and Alzheimer's and eye problems, or is that a reach?
Well, I don't think it's out of reach. I don't think there's been any direct correlation yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to find there be some, because the eyes being so closely involved with the brain area itself, a lot of these, the blood supply is a joint blood supply that goes to the brain and to the eyes. So they're very closely intertwined. And as, you know, as everybody's heard, the eyes are actually an extension of the brain, if you will. So in that sense, they're very closely linked.
So the nutrient balance in terms of adequate protein is going to be important, since amino acids are neurotransmitters.
Sure.
Right.
Absolutely.
And then good old vitamin C, which is one of our most powerful things to aid circulation in the body. I mean, it's
right.
Really a heavy hitter.
As a matter of fact, I've research is starting to show that vitamin C is actually good for cataracts as well.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and the which actually is not a surprise to me, because when I was doing some looking at some of the research on vitamin C, I realized that the lens inside the eye, which is where a cataract forms, has no direct blood supply. There's no arteries or veins going near the lens itself. It receives all its nutrients from the fluid surrounding it. And this fluid, called the aqueous fluid, has the highest concentration of vitamin C in the body. So that, to me, was a definite indicator that vitamin C would be important in maintaining the metabolism of the lens itself.
Another important thing is that if there's insufficient dietary fat in the diet, these fat-soluble vitamins are not going anywhere.
Right.
They're not going to get circulated. So mm-hmm. Adequate fat in the diet. Now, I was very pleased to see that you were a little cautious about not having too, there's this issue about balance with fats, having enough of the fats that decrease inflammatory situations and enough of the ones that are polyunsaturated balanced with the ones that are monounsaturated and saturated. So you do discuss fat balance. I have to say that I don't completely agree with you about the dangers of saturated fats. I think that's been overemphasized. But
well, yeah, it was just, you know, it's mainly just the general basic American diet. You know, it's just so overly inundated with saturated fat.
Well, it's not really inundated with saturated fat. It's inundated with fake fat.
Okay.
Things like trans fatty acids and hydrogenated fats and damaged fats that have been, you know, polyunsaturates that have been fried and refried and refried that are full of damaged fats. Let's talk a bit about childhood learning disabilities and vision.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot in this book about the development of the eyes and the importance of good nutrition during pregnancy. So let's talk a little bit about visual development. You say looking at the whole child, that there are early symptoms that you need to observe in a child. What might they be?
Well, the interesting part here is that we don't think of the eyes in development very much. And the eye, for the most part, is pretty well developed at birth. As a matter of fact, that's why babies look like they have such large eyes, is because the cornea, the front surface of the eye, is pretty much full grown by the time children are born. But the rest of the eye has to develop more, and especially the macular area that we discussed before, that area is not formed totally by birth, and that is actually developed as we learn how to see clearly. As we get clear images focused on the retina, then that area is developed more accurately as we grow. But the basic nutrition to start this whole process is, you know, obviously very important. But again, it's the tricky part here is that parents don't think about having their child's eyes checked. And what really kind of is the core of my motivation here is the school screening vision screenings, where most parents will think that their children's eyes are getting checked in school, and they're not. They're not very well at all. And I've lectured to school nurses and had feedback from them, and they realize that they don't do an adequate job, and unfortunately, they have to do something, and unfortunately, they don't, do as much as they can.
You're listening to Dr. Jeffrey Anschell, who is an optometrist who's written a lovely book called Smart Medicine for Your Eyes, published by Avery Publishing Group. It's a large paperback, which discusses, among other things, remedies for conventional and nutritional and homeopathic eye treatments. So a mixture of therapies for the eyes, and it does a very good job of discussing all of these things. And it is sort of an encyclopedia of eye disorders, so you can look stuff up and go, oh, maybe I better go get that checked. So,
and I'm also not there to, the book is not designed to replace an eye doctor.
No, you make that clear, actually.
It's designed to give people more information about their eyes so they can, you know, start the process, and a lot of the process that that it takes to maintain or reverse eye problems, maintain healthy eyes or reverse problems, starts with the person themselves.
Well, let's go back to children for a minute, because children are not going to have much of a clue about this. They're just going to suddenly not be able to read well in school and suddenly be given a label of some kind of behavioral disorder.
Right. And interesting, that's where a lot of these problems do stem from, because the child just doesn't know how to use their eyes. Their eyes develop, and as they develop, they learn how to use them for the first 8 years or so. Actually, in school, they're learning how to see for those early years, and then about the time they reach about third grade or so, then they need to use those eyes, which may or may not be ready for the chore, to learn how to learn.
Well, just to back up for 1 second, as a parent, if a parent has a child who's doing poorly in school,
mm-hmm.
what sorts of things can a parent observe in order to get a sense of whether the child needs to have their eyes checked?
Well, there's several things. First of all, the appearance of the eyes. Are they crossed? Does the child squint a little bit? Do they turn their head to do things? Trying to change their body posture to make it easier for their eyes to see, which is what we do quite a bit. And then there's the behavioral problems that a child can come up with. Squinting again, a rigid body posture. They mostly avoid close work, and if a teacher gives them a half hour's worth of homework and it takes them an hour and a half or 2 hours to do it, well, there's a problem. They avoid doing that close work. They might even turn their head or sit too close to the work, using their finger to read, blinking a lot, those things. And then there's the complaints. There's the child complaining of blurred vision or headaches or nausea or burning or itching eyes, things like that. So just kind of paying attention, but also asking the questions. That's important.
One of the things that really impressed me as you went through, incidentally, my favorite part of the book is when you explain how, from the very beginning, how a child's eyes develop
mm-hmm.
Throughout life. And I have to say, I was laughing out loud when you were discussing this whole thing of why little babies take everything and immediately put them in their mouths.
Right.
That this is a way of feeling things because they're not focusing that well yet.
Yep.
So it's nice to find out why. Because, adults who still do this, and you wonder what that is. But
that's different,
yeah, though it may be related, but
yeah.
Different. But the thing that really sort of took me up was that the first trimester is so critical in the development of the eye, and so many women get pregnant and don't even realize they're pregnant right away.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that's when you say that nutrition is the most critical.
Well, that's where some of the basic cells that establish the foundation of the human being are developed. And good nutrition at that time is very critical.
You also mentioned something that I thought was unique and kind of took me back also, which is that you make a plea for not rushing infants into walking.
Right. Yes. Vision is actually what we call a visual motor process. And by that I mean that it takes into account not only the eyes, but how the eyes integrate with the rest of the body. Because we use our eyes not only for seeing, but for other things like moving and balance and things like that. So we need to develop in a certain order. And if we don't pay attention to that order, if we rush through one of those stages of development, it may be lacking in the development of the child and may cause problems further on. This has been actually researched by a number of people and actually people in the physical therapy and chiropractic areas have also looked at this area quite a bit. Because our first muscles that develop are the large ones, what we call gross motor movements, muscles of the arms and legs and back and neck, things like that. They're larger muscles that start to develop. It allows the child to go from just the lying position to raise themselves. And then finer motor muscles start to develop, the fingers and toes, wrists and ankles, things like that. Then they learn to manipulate things a little bit better. And then there's the ocular motor, which the eye muscles are even finer than the finger muscles. They're smaller and more delicate, and they have to learn how to coordinate with each other. So again, it needs to happen in a particular order. And we'd like to see a child being able to crawl and be able to develop those large muscle groups adequately and coordinate the muscles so they learn that process of coordination, so that when it gets to the point where their eyes are starting to develop and learn how to move together, they can learn how to coordinate, and the child's already learned that process.
And I think, am I right in saying that this has something to do with the development of spatial, the perception of spatial relationships, or is that something else that you are advocating, that people sort of play games with their children and help them learn? You're saying that learning and reading is somewhat dependent on the development of this understanding of spatial relationships.
Right, absolutely. Oh, sure. The just the basic thing where we look at dyslexia, and we see people confusing letters like P and Q and B and D, which are basically the same. If you look at the letters, the P and the Q, they're basically the same letter upside down, and then the B and the D, the same letter backwards and forwards. So it's the old stick in the ball type of figure. It's just oriented in different positions. And we need to learn how to differentiate those different positions by looking at something and say, okay, this is the left and that's the right. You know how children before they're 8 years old frequently confuse left and right. And if this isn't a learned thing that they can be able to put into the space and learn how to differentiate left and right in space, they're going to have trouble reading.
In addition, in terms of reading, you mentioned the fact, and you cite the research, that there's some research to support the possible relationship between dyslexia and light sensitivity, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, that's an area that's still undergoing some scrutiny. There's a psychologist known as Helen Erlin, who came up with lenses that colored lenses that help people read better. And that's where the light sensitivity theory started coming into vogue. And I feel there's some credence to her theories. And I don't know if it's as cut and dried as she promoted it to be, but I think there is something there in how the visual system processes light and contrast and letters and things like that it's definitely worth looking into.
Well, fortunately, you cite the research, and you also sort of give people a way to move on and check into that further in the book. Again, the book we're talking about is Smart Medicine for Your Eyes, and I'm talking with Jeffrey Anschell, Dr. Jeffrey Anschell. So I'm going to be talking about light. You also make a plea for people not to buy cheap sunglasses.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I have to say I've fallen into this trap. As long as it says UV protection, I think, okay, cool.
That's right.
But you say not.
Yeah, it's too common, right. And I've had several patients in the office who think that they come in with good sunglasses, and it's fairly easy for me in the office to show them how mistaken they are. The problem with sunglasses is, the type of lens that's in there. It can be UV protective, which is kind of good if you're spending a lot of time in the sun. However, the quality of the lens, it's not an optically round lens. It's just basically kind of stamped out from a piece of plastic and just, stuck into the frame without, care. And again, the thickness of the lens doesn't support it. So if you, in the office I use a projector to shine the letters on the wall, the chart of letters. Well, I just take their sunglass lens and hold it over the projector and see what the letters look like. And a lot of times it just blurs the image so much you can't even tell what the letters are anymore. So that's a pretty easy test for me to show people how their sunglasses may or may not be working properly.
What about this? The sunglasses that are supposedly designed specifically for using in the car that are amber rather than gray?
The amber lens does help contrast a little bit, but I don't like people to think that they're, if they're having trouble driving at night, a lot of times they'll use those for night driving glasses. And really, I haven't seen any research that's shown that that's actually very effective, because any tint you put in a lens does start to decrease the amount of light through.
Yeah, and how?
So if you're using anything to help you drive at night, at nighttime you're getting, too little light in as it is. And so you need to caution that. More than likely, it may be another type of visual problem. And actually, this is something I hear a lot from computer users as they go home at night and they say, well, I can't see at night. I must have night blindness. and when in fact it's just, you know, overstraining from looking at the computer all day.
Are we saying now that a good pair of sunglasses are only available through an ophthalmologist or an optometrist?
No, not at all. There are sunglass stores that have good quality lenses, and it's hard to say exactly, you know, which ones. You know, if somebody wants to just look at the surface of the lens with a reflected light over it and move it back and forth, they could look at the pattern of the light and see it's not waving at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very cursory way of telling if the glasses are good. In general, if they're going to pay, I don't know, around the $50 or more range, usually they're going to get some pretty good sunglasses. So it's a real easy way to...
$50?
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, dear. To have to absolutely not lose them. They have to be chained to your body somehow.
Well, that's the thing. The more you pay for them, the more care you're going to take of them.
We hope so.
We hope so.
All right, TV and computer. Any little things you want to just...
Oh, there's lots.
There's lots?
I lecture on computer use, and there are a lot of things that... You know, people are, you know, we're looking at computer screens so much these days, and we've basically gone from a horizontal work mode to a vertical work mode, where we're, instead of just looking down at books or paper, we're now looking straight ahead at a computer screen. Number one, the quality of the letters. Computer screens cannot generate the quality of an image as you can with ink on paper. So the quality of the image is poor. So when people are looking at their computer screens, they're looking at a poorer quality image, not able to focus on that image quite as sharply as they can on paper, and it's going to cause their focusing to kind of, you know, waver a little bit, trying to find that clearest point, and that can cause eye strain quite a bit.
So I would think that the illumination of the room is important.
Right, and that's the other part of it. It is a self-illuminated object versus paper, which reflects light. So most offices tend to be set up for paperwork, and if they are, and then you start using a computer in that same lighting environment, it's probably going to be too bright for you. So you may need to tone down. What I tell people is to try to get the background of the monitor and the surrounding illumination approximately equal, or about a 3-to-1 ratio or less. So, you know, approximately equal in the background illumination and the background of the screen itself. And we also tend to blink less as far as the behavioral thing. We tend to stare at the screen, we don't look away, and we don't blink. And we also don't breathe. That's why I have my 3B approach to reducing these problems called blink, breathe, and break.
And I've noticed that you like full-spectrum light bulbs, too.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by full-spectrum, it's not necessarily that we got to be careful about that, because people tend to think that, well, we're getting more UV in there. It's not the UV that we're after. It's the balance of the light that we're getting through the bulb.
And when you're watching television, not in the total dark, you can watch films in the total dark, but not movies in the total dark?
Bigger screen.
Bigger screen you can watch in total darkness.
Exactly. So you're more of your field of view is being hit with the dominant light versus watching TV in the dark. And that's the same thing for the computer screens. Again, approximately equal background illumination and surrounding illumination being approximately equal. You want that with TV as well.
What a shame. We're going to have to take a brief break here, and we'll be right back. We're talking, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm talking with Dr. Jeffrey Anschel, who is an optometrist. He's written a wonderful book called Smart Medicine for Your Eyes, which not only includes a tremendous amount of information about vision and nutrition and development of vision, etc., but also gives some specific suggestions to look at with specific eye disorders, goes through them and whatnot. So we're going to get into that shortly. We will be right back, so hang tight.
The weight of all my dreams press on me. Ghosts of all I might have been gather round me in a crowd. It's easy to lose faith and say the way I chose was wrong. Till I look into your eyes and see love deep as the road is long. When the evening stars
look at some alternatives, at least first. Hopefully, if problems do develop, they're early in development and they're minor, and might be able to take care of them without getting to the point of needing more potent drugs.
Well, but aside from the drugs that we use for our vision, there are drugs that people are taking for any number of various pathologies or irritable symptoms of one sort or another, and they have
a problem.
Right,
side effects, right.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different drugs that people are using for different problems. The two main areas that we find are concern are high blood pressure, hypertension, and diabetes.
Which interestingly are all problems that have circulatory basis for them, including diabetes. Diabetics have terrible circulatory problems until they get their blood sugars under control. So again, you know, if people would please just look at using nutrition and exercise, dietary changes, and using supplements, you know, before they just immediately succumb to taking these medications, they would probably save other parts of their bodies along the way as time went on.
Yeah, and especially with diabetes, so much of it can be controlled with
diet.
Right.
Yep. Okay. Now, since are there any major? You know, so you're saying mostly the ones that affect those problems are the ones to watch out for. With and ironically, those are the ones like diabetes where you don't want to have eye problems anyway because you might have.
Right. Yeah. Those are the two main ones that do affect the eye. The two diseases that affect the eye significantly, and those are the ones we look out for quite a bit.
Now. You in the section where you discuss herbs, you have a section of the best and most common herbs that are used for eyes, and then you have a bunch of herbal combinations, and then you have herbs to be cautious with.
Right.
Now, one of the things that was a little bit confusing is that some of the herbs you say to be cautious with, and I guess cautious is the word here, not that you have to avoid them altogether, you sometimes recommend them for certain conditions.
Yeah, they'll also have side effects as well, so you have to know what you're doing.
Well, I think herbalists, in general, when they work with herbs, do a kind of balancing act with them and also keep in mind the terrain or whatever, ecology of the person.
Right, and hopefully they do, but... and that's the key there, is working with an herbalist. I make sure to tell people that, taking herbs on your own can be a problem. And, a lot of our basic medications were derived from herbs to begin with, and they all have potential side effects.
Well, I just want to comment on what you just said, because I think that there's been a lot of attacks in the news lately of herbal medicine. And all kinds of stuff, even homeopathy to some degree. And I think that there's a misunderstanding here. It is the case that you can get yourself real uncomfortable by taking the wrong combination of herbs or the herb that's not appropriate for you. You could potentially really do damage to yourself, but you'd have to really take a boatload of them for the most part. There are some that are quite toxic, but they're not that easily available. For the most part, when you look at the numbers of people who have been had ill effects or side effects from taking herbal or alternative style medications, it's nothing compared to the deaths, the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are dying all the time from pharmaceuticals. So.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, and it's more of going to be a discomfort type of thing rather than something that's life-threatening with the herbs. So.
But there are things like, I was very surprised to see ginseng on there, and I guess what you're saying is that taken incorrectly, ginseng can increase, for instance, ocular pressure, which could be a problem for people who have a tendency toward glaucoma.
Glaucoma, right. So, yeah, if you're taking it for one thing, that's fine, but, you know, if there's a tendency toward glaucoma in the family, well, you might want to, be careful of that.
And another one that was common that I was surprised to see is ginger, which is often recommended to women as a kind of, some people call it the women's ginseng. But in fact, too much ginger, too much of anything, I think, unbalanced.
There's the key.
Yeah. And garlic. Garlic for some people will be...
great for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. So people maybe who are running really hot or have a problem with pressure, you know, in the eyes would want to be careful.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess you also do a very good job of mentioning homeopathic remedies that are worth checking. A nice thing about homeopathy is that you're dealing with these dilutions that you can't even trace.
Exactly.
So you're unlikely.
A bottle full and won't kill you.
Yeah, nothing terrible will happen to you.
Right.
So let's go, in the remaining time, let's go through some common pathologies that affect the eyes and talk about what they can do as a start for talking about common eye disorders and their treatments. Some of the things that affect the eye that are other types of pathologies, which are unfortunately somewhat common in this culture, is multiple sclerosis and Graves are two. Do you want to say anything about either of those?
Sure. Well, actually, the first signs that most people come up with when they have MS are visual signs. And
it's true of diabetes as well. Diabetes also has early. Sometimes people have vision changes.
Okay. Yeah. Because when we look at a diabetic, the some of the signs that signs that we see do happen later on. As far as the retina in the blood vessels.
The actual damage, but I've talked to people who, when they first started to have high blood sugar.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, that's the thing with the diabetics is they'll notice vision changes. And as a matter of fact, I've had patients who've been diabetics and have 6 or 7 pairs of glasses.
Oh.
And they'll try them on in the morning and see which one works the best. Because that's, because blood sugar will affect our vision that much. So, yeah, for diabetes, yes, you're right.
But I interrupted you. You were going to say something about multiple sclerosis and Graves.
Okay. MS, you know, changes in color vision, blind spots, even just losing their vision, or seeing double. That's a very, you know, losing their eye coordination. And the eye muscles start jerking a little bit. It's basically, you know, because, again, the eye muscles are so fine and we're using them so much, that's those are some of the early symptoms of it.
Some suggestions?
Routine eye exams, always a good thing to do. Nutritionally, things like choline and inositol. Coenzyme Q has been real good for improving tissue oxygenation and strengthening the immune system. And B complex, very good for nerves.
Good for almost everything.
Right. Yeah.
Graves' disease, really, really dicey stuff, really hard to work with in a natural way.
It is. Graves is, you know, it's a thyroid condition, and it's something that it's tricky to, you know, to work with. I don't have any magic bullets for this one.
Nobody does.
Yeah, and
let me ask you something. I have a consulting practice. I'm an educator, and I saw someone who said that she had only ocular Graves.
Yeah, basically it's the thickening of the eye muscles that actually tend to push the eyes out a little bit, and they get that protrusion look that's classic with Graves' disease. Why that would be not affect the rest of her body, I'm not sure.
And what would you do about that? Is there any way to, when someone's being treated, sometimes even when they treat Graves, well, you also caution against using using radiation, radioactive iodine,
mm-hmm.
Which I agree. Even if they're using the antithyroid meds and various things, or eating boatloads of raw cruciferous vegetables, which I think does help because of the thiocyanates, and mm-hmm. high thiocyanate foods will reduce thyroid function, will interfere with thyroid function, which would be good for someone who has hyperthyroidism. So millet and raw cruciferous vegetables and some of the tropical yams are loaded with thiocyanates.
Mm-hmm.
But the eye protrusion is a real problem, and have you discovered anything naturally that can help with that?
No, as a matter of fact, I'm on an internet list of eye care professionals around the world, and somebody had just recently posted a question asking about the reversal of that condition, and no one's really come up with anything that works. But one of the things is because the eyes tend to bulge like that, a lot of times the lids won't cover them. Completely, and when people go to sleep, there's some exposure of the eye to the environment, and they will tend to dry and have a chronic dry eye problem. So that's something they may want to actually get a surgical tape and actually tape their eyelids shut when they go to sleep.
That's nice.
Sure, they're covered.
That's great, honey. Could you please tape my eyes shut? Thank you. Could you please untape my eyes? Removing the tape would be fun too.
Surgical tape.
Not surgical tape.
Easier.
Right. Yeah.
No, you're not gonna
surgical tape is easier. Okay.
Hopefully, maintain some eyelashes there.
It'd be nice.
Yeah.
So we talked a bit about macular degeneration. You talked about the importance of circulation and the antioxidants with those. And my sense is that many of the most common things that crop up, like glaucoma and cataracts, are also related to those two issues.
Yes, glaucoma is an interesting one. The trickiest part about glaucoma is that there are no symptoms. And so somebody will not be aware that they have it. And that's why it's critical. That's why it's the leading cause of blindness, and that's why it's so important for people to get their eyes checked on a regular basis to, at the very least, check their eye pressure to make sure it's not too high. And also, eye pressure and blood pressure are totally not related to each other.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, they're totally different circulation processes, and they're different. And the glaucoma tends to happen more as you get older, so that's why they look at it as an aging condition. But you know, I've seen it in younger people as well. And there are some factors that lead to people having it more than others. But if it's in the family, there's a good chance that you need to have it looked at for sure, because there's a family tendency for it to happen.
Yeah, that's the reason to get eye exams, even if your eyes are seeming to be okay.
Exactly.
Huh?
Everybody says, oh, I see okay. Well, that's nice, but...
I'm a good example of that, actually.
Uh-huh. Okay, I won't ask you how long it's been.
Actually, only about 2 years.
Only.
Which it really should be every year, huh?
That's what I recommend.
Oh, yeah, see, my... my engineer today is nodding, and she is an eyeglass person. So.
Yes, so she's aware.
She knows. CMV is a cyclomegavirus, which megalovirus, which is just as awful as it sounds, is a problem with people whose immune system.